Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 22nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District in New York City. It is Casual Friday, and ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't get any more casual than this Friday for me because my voice has actually been pre-recorded. That's right. I'm so casual right now, I'm not even live. I'm sitting somewhere on a chaise lounge, probably already starting to weep because my vacation is ending today. But I roll right into the weekend, and, you know, I got a couple more days of vacation. I'm so jonesing to be back live. I can't even tell you right now. I'm going stir crazy. I'm kicking the dog, and it's not even my dog. So I'm also spending some time working out some type of compensation or with the neighbor because they don't like me kicking their dog. Not that I have anything against dogs, but you know, you can't kick your kid. I've learned that on several occasions. So folks, sit back and enjoy this freshly minted show. It is the last of vacation week. It's Casually Friday. Will Chris Rosen be on? I don't know. You're going to have to stick around until after this interview. Maybe I interviewed him. Maybe I didn't. Do you really care? Honestly? Seriously? Okay, folks, enjoy. I will see you Monday. I will be back. And remember, if you can become a member, that would be great. You know, I mean, you can enjoy the show when you're on vacation. I'm still working even on my vacation. Don't forget to click the Amazon link and buy your purchases from Amazon through that link. You'll redistribute money from them to me. And as well, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Put the coupon code majority in the coupon code box. You will get 10% off. Bam. What do you think about that? All right, folks. See you on Monday. Enjoy the rest of the show. So, folks, it is my pleasure to welcome to the program David Sirota. You know him. Well, gosh. Well, first of all, he is the author of Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live In Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. Of course, Sirota has been a longtime guest on this program. He has a weekly column that runs for Creators Syndicate. It appears in newspapers across the country. And he is a radio host of the one of the top-rated morning shows in Colorado. And so it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show. And here is the interview I did with him. This actually ran originally on Ring of Fire, but it was so good I wanted to do it again here. And we'll have David back, of course, in the future. But here is that interview now. So, David, Back to Our Future. This is, well, let's start with this. This is a little bit of a departure for you, isn't it, on some level?
It's a big departure. I mean, it's political. The book is political, but it's also about pop culture. And what the book basically argues is that as much as we attribute the enduring legacy of the 1980s to Ronald Reagan and the Reagan Revolution, that a lot of the themes, the political themes out of that era, were being echoed by parts of our media world that we don't think of as political, and specifically pop culture, and more specifically, entertainment culture aimed at a lot of 80s kids, TVs, movies, toys, video games, you name it. In the 1980s and beyond, those mediums had messages embedded in them that were really, I argue, reinforcing a lot of the narratives of the Reagan Revolution, and they still endure today.
Yeah, let's talk about give me some examples about what these themes were and why you think they were there.
Well, to me, the most obvious one is a lot of the themes that we hear from the right today about the government and about where we want to take this country. Obviously, everybody remembers Ronald Reagan saying, the government is the problem, the government is the source of our problems, and we, I think a lot of us in politics attribute that, the rise of that, as a defining aspect of our politics. We remember that as the consequence of Ronald Reagan, but this is a message that was embedded in a lot of the television shows and movies aimed specifically at children who have become today's world-shaping adults today. So I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, think about what the A-Team. The A-Team was the top-rated show among preteens in the 1980s, kids 2 to 11. Think about the premise of the A-Team. What is the A-Team saying? The A-Team is saying, and was saying over and over again.
Now, wait, we should remind people what the A-Team was. It was Mr. T.
Right.
Who were the A-Team?
Right. The A-Team was a group of ex-commandos that had been wrongly imprisoned, and you're told this at the beginning of every show, wrongly imprisoned for a quote-unquote crime they didn't commit. They promptly escape from prison to the Los Angeles underground to basically solve society's problems where the government refuses to solve them. And the message of the A-Team, and by the way, this is the message of the Dukes of Hazzard, right? The Dukes of Hazzard were outsiders who were solving problems where the corrupt municipal government of Hazzard County refuses to solve them. This was the message of the Ghostbusters, where the municipal government, the military, can't stop the ghosts in New York. The message of all these products is that you can't rely on the government. You have to rely on the outsider, and in some cases, specifically, the private contractor. So this is one of the messages. One of the other messages of the 1980s pop culture was that if you can rely on the government, the only people in the government you can rely on are the rogues, the people who go rogue inside the government against the government. So I'm talking about, you know, Die Hard, all of the cop dramas, all of the private detective dramas. And of course, this is what endures today, right? Every politician is running to say, I'll get elected and I'll go rogue. And so much of our policies at the federal and state level are about how you can't trust the government. The government can't do anything right. We've got to privatize services. And these narratives may have been with us for a long time in American culture, but as the polling shows, they didn't start sticking until the 1980s. And I think that's because it was sold to us in parts of our mediascape that are more influential than politics, because the pop culture parts of our mediascape are the parts that we don't even recognize as political.
And so, I mean, how did this come about? So we have these notions of the Dukes of Hazzards who are the guys that we would, you know, these sort of rebels. I mean, literally, they had, if I remember correctly, they had a rebel flag painted mm-hmm. on the mm-hmm. front of their Dukes of Hazzard car. They were more trustworthy than the cops and the boss hog, mm-hmm. who was sort of the crony. I don't know if he was the mayor or just like the county administrator or whatever.
Exactly.
He was.
He was like the politician, right? The county politician.
And so where did these emanate from? I mean, were they distinct from the rise of Reagan? Was the message of Reagan, had that sort of permeated our culture? Was it a backlash? I mean, what accounts for it?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a question of did the Reagan Revolution create the political zeitgeist of the moment, or did the political zeitgeist of the moment create the Reagan Revolution and the popular culture that reinforced it? And I think it's symbiotic. Right, I think that coming out of the Watergate controversy, coming out of the Vietnam War, where people naturally were distrustful of the government, and frankly, in a fairly rational and progressive way, the Reagan Revolution did a really good job of turning that suspicion into a right-wing narrative, and I think the popular culture, people who write screenplays, people who write TV shows, there's no conspiracy. They're not trying to propagandize. They're simply trying to meet people where people already are. So I think a lot of this came from pop culture creators in the 1980s who were simply looking for the shortest of shorthand to meet the culture where it already was, to try to get ratings, to try to sell tickets to movies. And what ended up happening was these narratives, these storylines that we tell ourselves, kept being told over and over and over again. And we keep telling ourselves these storylines because there hasn't been really alternative storylines really introduced into the pop or political culture of today.
Now, how do you differentiate between this notion of sort of the, you know, the rebels as opposed to the government from, you know, like in the Dukes of Hazzard, let's say, and A-Team, and I imagine in the context of, you know, maybe you could probably, War Games is another example, I guess, where you have, how would you make a distinction between those rebels, and you look at things like 3 Days of the Condor, or a Capricorn One, which followed sort of like a similar notion. You know, 3 Days of the Condor was very much about a sort of a rogue element of our government and a roguer element of that government sort of taking them down. Capricorn One was the idea that the government was perpetrating a hoax on America based upon the moon landing, which incidentally also starred O.J. Simpson. And another sort of twist of fate. How was that distinct? Because those, on some level, it's certainly 3 Days of the Condor, and there are other examples that seem to be more sort of like a sense of distrust that came from the left. I mean, how did that mutate into one that sort of supported a conservative narrative?
Well, because I think that what happened was is that the conservative argument needed to account for the things that the government does undeniably well, right? I mean, no matter how much you demonize the government does do things undeniably either well or not controversial, right? I mean, it does catch criminals. It does build roads. It does complete municipal services, social services. So the conservative argument kind of required a way to explain that. And so you had, for instance, a lot of after-school specials that were about how somebody looking for social services or help from the government was lucky enough to find some good Samaritan inside a bad bureaucracy in the government who could help them solve their problem. It's the same thing with the idea of the idea of Die Hard, right? Die Hard, it's all about a guy saves the world or saves Los Angeles from a terrorist attack. He's a police officer. But he saves Los Angeles by going rogue against the police bureaucracy. So I agree with you. There was a kind of, in the 70s, a progressive pop culture meme that the government was dark and conspiratorial. The right wing, I think, appropriated that, and the kind of right wing moment in the pop culture of the 1980s appropriated that by saying, yes, the government does accomplish certain things well, and we've got to explain that. But the way we're going to explain that is what has become the John McCain argument. You've got people inside, good people, good individuals inside the government who are willing to go rogue against the evil system. And I would argue that the bad part about this is this treats Americans, this teaches Americans to distrust systems and institutions. And John Adams was the one who said, you know, we are a nation of laws, not a nation of men. The argument out of the 1980s is actually that you can't trust laws, you can't trust systems, you can't trust institutions. You can only trust, if you're lucky enough to find them, single good individuals.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, let's talk more about this, because I'm still sort of like fascinated by this idea of that was also, you know, that message you just described is also something that was a byproduct of Watergate, but somehow it mutated into this frame. We will talk about that and the notion of the sort of the sentimentality of the good old days that brought us Ronald Reagan, who you mentioned in some respects, you note that people referred to him as just having sort of a mind full of just sort of all of these sort of like moments that we might have seen in Hallmark cards from the from the early 60s and late 50s. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. So, David, when we took a break, we were talking about this notion of somehow the right capitalized on this notion of these big governmental bureaucracies that didn't function, and it took an individual who relied on only his individuality in some ways to cut through this bureaucracy. And, you know, when I hear something like that, I compare sort of the Die Hard character that you use as an example for that with the Dirty Harry character who was sort of similarly situated, had a problem, in particularly in the later Dirty Harrys that took place in the 70s. The Enforcer comes to mind, I think it was, where the system itself was bucking this notion of how we were letting criminals all go, and it was the soft-hearted liberals who were allowing this to happen. But somehow that mutated and sort of expanded in some way beyond criminal law into sort of just this general notion of you can't trust these institutions even to do the most basic of functions. To what degree do you think this was also a function, and you mentioned in your book, you talk about Reagan came in and he was very much presenting to America this notion of mourning in America that was to recall a happier times, I guess, presumably for white people in the early 60s and the late 50s. The 80s was the sort of the first decade you described as sort of coming back to that sort of sentimentality for the good old days.
Absolutely, and this is a huge, huge thing that comes out of the 1980s. It's the creation of the 50s, which is a distinct brand from the actual years of the 1950s. The 50s comes out of the 1980s, and the 60s, again, distinct from the actual 1960s. This brand comes out of the 1980s through the movies, through music. I mean, there was a big revival of rockabilly music, through styles, clothing styles, through Ronald Reagan. I mean, Ronald Reagan was a guy who was always referring back to the mid-20th century as this time of greatness for America, really a candidate, as Time magazine called him, of nostalgia. This all melded together to make the argument that the 1950s was a time of great national unity, of patriotism, kind of wiped away from the American psyche the idea that the 1950s was also a time of religious and racial bigotry, a terrible time for women who were in a kind of leave it to beaver, male chauvinist society. And similarly, the pop culture and politics of the 1980s created this idea of the 60s not as a time of progress for equality, but as a time only of chaos, only of violence, only of decadence and unrealistic idealism. I mean, you see this, I'll give you a good example of that, is one of the most popular shows on TV in the 1980s was Family Ties. And the fulcrum of the comedy in Family Ties is the kind of 80s yuppie, young yuppie, Alex P. Keaton, or aspiring yuppie, making fun of his parents' 60s decadence, 60s unrealistic idealism. This, of course, this notion of the 80s version of the 50s versus the 80s version of the 60s dominates our politics today. Every time a Democrat runs for president, the Republicans inevitably try to tie him or her to the 80s version of the 60s. Last time we saw the Republicans trying to say that Barack Obama was, you know, buddy-buddy with Bill Ayers, who was became this cartoonish version of the 80s version of the 60s. And you have the Republicans always trying to say, we want to go back to the 50s. I mean, you hear that all the time when the Tea Party folks literally quoted, and I quote them in my book all over the place, saying we want to go back to 1955, we want to go back to 1954, the 50s were better. They're not actually talking, although maybe some of them are, but they're not banking on Americans thinking of the actual 1950s. They're banking on Americans thinking of the 80s version of the 1950s, that Hill Valley that Marty McFly travels back to in Back to the Future.
The irony here is that if there was one notion about those 50s that I think sort of, because you can't account for different groups in our society who were not sort of even actually sort of in any way emancipated at that time, what you're really talking about is a time of financial security. I mean, that's the sort of the odd thing about this. They never talk about the fact that, you know, sort of you had a significantly higher portion of millionaires, what would have been millionaires in equivalent dollars back in the late 50s, early 60s, paying a greater share of their income, effective tax rates, to support society. It sort of leaves out that aspect of it. So there's almost
absolutely,
like
absolutely, you're right. They're not talking about the 1950s of a 90% top tax rate. They're not talking about a 1950s of a huge amount of what we call today stimulus dollars being spent to build the interstate road system. Somehow, that's been wiped clear of what we think of as the quote-unquote 50s. And some would argue that the Tea Party folks, when they say refer to the 50s, they're actually deliberately referring to a time of white privilege. Now, I think that some Tea Party folks, because I think there is a racial element to some of the Tea Party, I think some Tea Party folks probably are referring to that deliberately or even subconsciously. But I think most of that rhetoric is more kind of vague, kind of theoretical. This notion, this image of black and white televisions, and there supposedly wasn't divisiveness. There was a wide middle class. Although let's wipe away how we got that middle class with higher tax rates and better investment. It's this notion that it was a quote unquote simpler time, and it wipes away all of the progress that we made in the 1960s that we now take for granted.
And so you've taken they've managed to take the financial security and recommodified that into taking that good feeling and turn it into a commodity. But the commodity is in fact a different reflection than the reality that existed at that time. Tell me, we only have a minute here, but tell me what accounts for this? I mean, is it something beyond the idea that we know that in advertising and in television industry, it is 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds who dominate essentially in those industries in terms of turning out the creative stuff, and that people are sort of reminiscing and in some way sweetening their childhoods in some way, and I just want to sort of replay that. Is it more than that, or is that simply a function, and we just somehow the needle got stuck in that?
I think it's exactly that. I think it's children of the 1980s are now creating the culture of today, and the reason why the culture of the 1980s was so powerful was both because a lot of it, as we discussed, was aimed at children, and because the 1980s was the first time that the media industry, the way to deliver propaganda, was as consolidated and efficient as it was. So by 1983, 50 companies controlled most major television stations, newspapers, movie houses, and other cultural productions. So there, in the 1980s, was the first time we were a tabula rasa, the first time that the media industry could sell us products in a cross-platform kind of way. You didn't see the parable in E.T. That said that the kids have to run away from the government. The government is what is the enemy. You didn't see that just on the movie screen. You saw that on your Happy Meal. You saw that on your video game system. You saw that on your lunchbox. So one of the reasons the 80s endures is because the children of the 80s who are shaping culture today were the first generation exposed to an instrument of propaganda that was perfectly calibrated to really hammer home these messages in a way that they had never been hammered home before.
Right, and completely cross-platformed.
Exactly.
Well, it's a fascinating book. The book is Back to Our Future by David Sirota. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So next up, an interview with Kevin Drum. He is a writer for the Washington Monthly. He had a great piece on the plutocracy, and it's an interview I did for Ring of Fire, but it was it's an excellent interview, and if you didn't hear it, this one's a pretty important one. It gives a really good sense of the history of how we've gotten to this point where unions are no longer receiving the support from the Democratic Party that they need to continue, and as such, the Democratic Party has lost a lot of support. So here's that interview with Kevin Drum now. So, Kevin, in your piece, Plutocracy Now, you know, you're talking about themes that I'm seeing talked about a lot, that we have such incredible, not just income distribution, or I guess a difference in a disparity in income distribution in this country, but we're also seeing the same disparity in terms of political power. And your piece outlines it. So let's just walk through this. I think we don't need to reiterate that there were expectations for Obama and a Democratic House and Senate that at least progressives feel were not met in terms of fundamentally changing the way that the super rich in this country and the corporations have so much seemingly control over the decisions in our society. So walk us through this. There are two things you start off that are crucial to understand about American politics.
There are. You know, one of them, when you talk about income inequality, a lot of people sort of think about income inequality being between, say, the upper middle class and the lower middle class. And that's really not where the big change has come. The big change has come in the very, very top, the top 1%, which has just run away from everybody, even the upper middle class. They've run away from. So pretty much all the money all the extra money, so to speak, that the country has generated over the last 30 years as the economy has grown, almost all of it, maybe two-thirds of it, has gone to that top 1%. So that's what's generated a huge amount of income inequality. And then the other thing I pointed out is that there's a growing body of academic research that says that basically Congress and the president really don't respond to anybody other than pretty much the upper middle class and the rich. If you look at evidence about what the poor, what the policy preferences of the poor are, the policy preferences of the lower middle class, and even the middle class, it turns out that Congress hardly reacts to that at all.
And we're talking about the vast majority of people. I mean,
yes,
we're talking about
upwards of 80% of the people.
Right. So congressional decision making is driven not necessarily even by those who voted for them as much as it is by the wealthy, and whatever the mechanics of that are, we're not necessarily dealing with that. But that's the reality of it.
That's right. It's driven by the upper middle class and the rich, almost exclusively. And you know, what I was trying to get at in my piece was, why is that? I mean, it hasn't always been that way. And so what is it that changed? And I think that what changed is that in the past, we had private sector labor unions who were a very big, very influential, very powerful set of organizations that represented not just their own members, but it turns out really represented the interests of the working class and the middle class. Writ large, and that's disappeared.
And we should talk about this, you know, in terms of the problems that this both economic disparity and this political disparity represent are that, one, from an economic standpoint, from a political standpoint, we see it across the board, right? I mean, our taxes are, as a percentage of GDP, are lower than they've been probably in about 60 years. Anybody making over $1 million is probably paying an ineffective tax almost 20 percentage points lower than they would have 60 years ago, 50 years ago. And it's corrosive to democracy, too, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. And if you want what I think is an even better example, is just take a look at the last couple of years. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago in 2008, the financial industry, Wall Street, literally within a hair's breadth of destroying the world. I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that. And yet, what's happened to them? Virtually nothing. Their profits are back, have bounced back. Bonuses are back to what they were back in 2007. The Dodd-Frank bill is a very, very weak set of regulations. They've gotten off almost completely scot-free. And you got to ask yourself, how can an industry, how can a set of people do that and somehow pay virtually no price?
Yeah, and I would even maybe argue that contrary to even paying no price, we have a bigger problem in terms of too big to fail because these banks are actually bigger now. And we have basically trained them. Our government has basically said, hey, you know how there may have been some type of moral hazard there and that we sort of gave you the notion that we would never let you fail? Well, now we've doubled down on that. So we're almost encouraging that behavior again.
Yes, I think you're right about that. There is something to that. And, you know, there are things we could have done about that. And we did a little bit of it, but almost nothing. I mean, you know, I was reading just the other day that Jamie Dimon was complaining about the increased regulation of banks, and I just had to laugh. I mean, his bank wasn't the worst of the bunch, but still, I mean, the regulations that have been put in place are just minuscule. I mean, very small changes in capital requirements, some fairly weak regulations on derivatives exchanges and things like that. His bank is going to be as big and as profitable, as you say, bigger, and maybe more profitable than it was before 2008.
Right. And he's the CEO. He's the CEO of Chase, of J.P.
Yes.
Morgan Chase.
Right.
So we have this situation where it's clearly it's been bad for the economy. If you measure what is good for the economy as being good for the vast majority of people, we have 30 years of stagnant wages. The only people, like you say, the only people who have like accrued wealth at a significant click has been this upper 1%. We have taxes on these people at sort of historic lows. When did this start happening and what happened?
Well, I think what happened, this was, the article that I wrote was I owed a big debt to a book called Winner Take All Politics by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. And here's what they say. They say if you look at income inequality, you can sort of break it up into two things. One is there are economic trends happening in the world that are driving some economic inequality. Okay? So that's one side of it. But that's not the whole story. The other side of the story is that a lot of income inequality is driven by politics. There are political decisions that are made, laws passed, agency rulings, and so forth, that are made that can either fight against this trend of income inequality or can make it worse. What they say is that to a large extent, over the last 30 years, politics has made it worse. And where I took that was, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. There's a lot of politics involved, and I think one of the big, big factors is that in the 30 years after World War II, you had private sector labor unions, which were a big, powerful force, institutional force. And when I say that, I mean it's somebody that politicians had to pay attention to. And they were fighting for the middle class. And then starting around in the late 70s, and this is a story I tell in my piece, private sector labor unions started to decline badly. And they kept declining through the 80s and through the 90s. And today, they're just a shadow of form themselves. And so there's nobody left. There are voters, right? There are a lot of middle-class voters, working-class voters. But politicians don't pay attention to voters. They pay attention to big institutional groups that can give them money, that can affect their future. And for the middle class, that doesn't exist anymore. Labor unions just aren't strong enough to do that. Whereas on the other side of the story, there are plenty of institutions left that represent big corporations, that represent the rich, that represent the financial industry. It's been completely one-sided for the last 30 years.
We've got to take a break, Kevin, but when we come back, let's talk about how we lost, and by we, I mean essentially those of us in the 80-90 percentile of this kind, the 80-90 percent whose political agenda and aspirations are not being pursued by the establishment. Let's talk about how that happened. It's actually, I think your assessment is going to be surprising to people, and we'll be right back to talk about that. So, Kevin, when we broke, we were talking about how unions, which had represented sort of the aspirations of all working class people, whether they were unionized or not, have lost their influence as an establishment. How did that happen? When did that first? They were a big, big institutional constituency of the Democratic Party and the left. When did that begin to fall apart?
Well, it started to fall apart, I think, largely in the late 60s. And, you know, the story I tell is that, you know, what happened is that the new left that rose in the 60s was not basically concerned with economic issues. They were concerned with the Vietnam War. They were concerned with feminism. They were concerned with civil rights, environmentalism, social issues, and non-economic issues for the most part. It just wasn't what animated them. And that drove a huge split in the Democratic Party. We saw that in 1968 in the Chicago convention, and then we saw it again in 1972 when George McGovern was nominated, and that's when the split really hit home. You had this old line, old left of big labor leaders who hated the new left, and the feeling was completely mutual. The new left considered labor leaders to be just a bunch of old line, middle-aged white guys, anti-communist white guys. And the labor leaders thought that the new left was just a bunch of women and shaggy-haired professors and gays, and they had no use for them. And that drove a huge split in the Democratic Party, and a lot of liberal energy went into those social issues and started moving away from economic issues.
So there was you're describing a cultural cleave here between those two parties.
Yes, very much. And that's changed, more recently. I mean, what I'm describing doesn't exist as much or even at all, hardly, today. But it did. In the late 60s and early to mid-70s, it absolutely did. And one of the things you have to understand about unions is that they can only exist, they can only thrive if they have government support. I mean, it's just absolutely critical you have a legal regime that supports unions. And to do that, you need a party that supports unions.
We should say that the same dynamic exists for corporations. I mean, if you don't have a legal framework for corporations, they also can't exist. Neither one of these things exist. And that's what started to happen, is that that legal framework and the protection and the support for that legal framework started to diminish.
Yes, I think that's true. I think I'd argue that it's far more true of unions than it is of corporations. But regardless, you're right. And the legal regime, like I said, requires government support and therefore requires support of a major political party. So when the Democratic Party gets split, its support for unions starts to decline. And, of course, union support was critical for Democratic Party power. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. One side declines, the other side declines. Unions decline, the party declines. Unions decline, the party declines some more. And, you know, by the early 90s, by the time everybody had sort of figured out what was really happening, it was too late. Private sector unions, which had once represented, 30% of the workers in the country, were down to about 10%. And today, of course, is down to about 7%. I mean, they've become tiny.
And the solution from the Democratic Party was, at this point, was to simply say, okay, unions are not what they were because we have institutionally not supported them in the way that they need their support to exist. And so they no longer can support us from an electoral standpoint. So what we need to do is get corporate money, and then we have the DLC.
Right. That's exactly right. And you can see that, as this plays out, there's almost no choice. Once that split happens in the Democratic Party, once support for unions starts to wane, Democrats, by the mid-80s, they almost don't have any choice, right? I mean, a big party has to have money and has to have influence to survive, and there's only just so many places that you can get that. And once union support started to decline, with the eager help of the Republican Party, obviously, then Democrats had to look elsewhere. And the elsewhere they looked was big corporations. And, they did not become sort of the handmaiden of big corporations that the Republican Party has always been, but they went about halfway there.
Right.
And so you have a really split party. They're not slaves of corporations, but, boy, they sure don't want to do much of anything to make them angry either.
Right. They may not be slaves, but they're certainly working for them in some regard, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So basically what you're talking about is the story that in some way, in the late 60s, unions were almost victims of their own success because they had created a working class and an upper middle class that felt financially secure. So much so that they were no longer animated by these issues that unions had traditionally fought for.
The unions themselves were still animated by that. But, I mean, if I can put it a different way, I might say that maybe the sons and daughters of those union members weren't. Because, as the Port Huron statement said so famously, they were the sons and daughters who had been born in at least moderately comfortable circumstances. And so you're right, they weren't. It didn't seem as important to them growing up in the 60s, growing up the way they did. And, of course, the unions, bear a huge amount of blame for this themselves. I mean, they were, to a large extent, they were lazy about trying to broaden their influence.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, spent way too much time fighting the New Left and fighting the social movements of the 60s. And that helped bring them down.
All right, we have just a very brief amount of time left, but one of the things I noticed when I was in Madison a couple of weeks ago was that you had people who were teachers' assistants at University of Madison who were the first people to be out there protesting and were joined ultimately by these same very blue-collar, hardcore union guys, and they were protesting at the same moment. Do you think that we're starting to see the beginnings of a return to an understanding by both of those two different parties, and particularly now that those social issues have all basically, or not all, been completely resolved, but certainly are not as contentious as they were, are we starting to see a fusion or between those concerns again, around those concerns?
Well, I think we are. I think unfortunately, it's probably too late. I think it's too late to expect that the union movement is really going to, you know, to ever become close to what it used to be. But yeah, I think people are. I think you are seeing that. At the very least, people don't want it to get any worse. They don't want to see unions destroyed any further than they have been. It's only too bad this didn't happen 20 or 30 years ago instead of right now.
Well, I got to tell you, Kevin, I hold out just a little bit more hope because one of the things I really noticed in Madison is that as much as that it's perceived as a union action there, it was really, in many respects, a labor action. And I don't know if what we will come out of that will be stronger unions, but I think to a certain extent, we're going to see people start to congeal around these issues in a way that may down the road lead to that more union support. But I guess time will tell. And the piece is great, and I really appreciate your talking to me about it.
Get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost the drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted in and out of.